right. Attempts to try and keep the truth confined, but they will not stop us, and we will emerge victorious. I love that song. I love that album. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that's Uprising from Muse and their albums, The Resistance. That's sort of going to be a theme of the show all the way through today. On the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign about their new project, Testimony, Equality on Trial. It's a very interesting project. I'll tell you about that a little bit later. It's busting through the blanket of censorship and that's been thrown over the ability of people to know what's actually being said during the Prop 8 trial. Before that, we'll be talking with Ray McGovern about a new ad that just appeared in the New York Review of Books, and it's called Crimes Are Crimes, No Matter Who Does Them. And it's something that's hitting at Obama as not only continuing, but even being in some ways even being worse than Bush, and saying that it doesn't matter who's doing them, crimes are crimes. But to open the show up along the same theme, we'll be speaking with Stephen Watt and Jennifer Turner, both from the ACLU. And Stephen will be talking with us about a request by a Spanish prosecutor for authorization to arrest 13 CIA agents for their involvement in extraordinary rendition. And we'll talk with Jennifer about the banning of reporters from the military tribunals in Guantanamo and the revelations of the torture and just the horrendous, I mean, bestial treatment of Omar Khadr and what it says about what's going on in this country today and in the world today and what it says about us allowing that to continue like that. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Jennifer, welcome to you, too.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. All right, we'll start out with Stephen. Stephen, what's going on with this Spain's call? You know, tell people what happened. Spain made a call for the arrest of CIA agents involved in extraordinary rendition. What's going on there?
Well, this request for the arrest of 13 CIA operatives arises from the case of Khaled El-Masri, and he's one of the many survivors of the extraordinary rendition program that have sought accountability of those involved. Khaled El-Masri is a German citizen, and at the end of 2003, he was on holiday in Macedonia in Eastern Europe. He was detained on alleged immigration violations by Macedonian authorities and held for 23 days under inhumane conditions before he was handed over to what we now know to be a CIA black rendition team. He was beaten, he was stripped of his clothing, he was drugged, and then he was flown halfway around the world to Afghanistan and a secret-run CIA prison in that country. He was held there for 5 months. He was tortured. And after those 5 months, he was released, but not back to his home in Germany. He was released onto a hilltop in the dead of night in Albania to find his own way back home to Germany. He's never been charged with any crime. And we represented Khaled El-Masri in federal court proceedings here in the United States to try and get him some measure of justice. And the domestic courts here threw the case out because the United States insisted that any litigation of the case would be harmful to U.S. national security interests. And lower courts threw the case out. The Supreme Court in 2007 basically upheld those lower court decisions. So he had no relief and there was no accountability for those individuals who were involved. This despite the fact, Michael, that there is a vast paper trail now of information, official documents, investigations carried out by foreign law enforcement authorities that show Khaled El-Masri is a survivor of the extraordinary rendition program and that U.S. officials were involved in that program.
It's interesting because this isn't the first time that different authorities have gone after elements from the U.S. I mean, you have even some of these, you know, fascists like Spain going after Pinochet and some of the other things that the who's the judge in Spain that's gotten all kinds of hell for advocating that that basically war criminals be held responsible for their actions. I think it was, a couple years ago or something that he actually advocated something around calling for the apprehension of various U.S. agents and I think actually even talking about some of the top war criminals in the Bush regime. But then it was also the thing that happened in Italy, and Germany also had an attempt to do this, right?
Yeah, Germany actually indicted the same 13 CIA operatives. They began an investigation into Khaled El-Masri's abduction. He's a German citizen, so they did the right thing by him and began an investigation. And that investigation culminated in uncovering the names of these 13 CIA operatives who were involved in his rendition. That was they were involved in flying the aircraft that took him from Macedonia to his torture hole in Afghanistan. So they issued arrest warrants for these 13 individuals too. There was never any formal extradition request put in by the German government, but there are 13 outstanding arrest warrants for these same 13 individuals in Germany as well now, it would appear, in Spain.
A quick reminder, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stephen Watts and Jennifer Turner from the ACLU about a Spanish prosecutor calling for the arrest of 13 CIA agents for their involvement with the extraordinary renditioning of Khalid al-Masri. Jennifer will join us shortly to talk about the upcoming prosecution of Omar Khadr in a Guantanamo military tribunal and the banning of four reporters from the coverage of that upcoming tribunal. Now, if Spain actually issues arrest warrants for these individuals, what are the charges they're actually facing? It seems to me that there's a couple of things that have been mentioned as possible charges. And then I want to know what the consequences of having charges lodged against them would be.
It will be charges under Spanish law, so I can't comment on that. But one would anticipate that it would be complicity in kidnapping and ultimately torture. I believe that's what the course of the investigation has probably resulted in. And what the consequences are, if there's an arrest warrant issued, then if any of those 13 individuals step foot in Spain, they'll be subject to arrest by law enforcement authorities there. But the fact that indictments were issued in Germany too means that there's a European arrest warrant out now for these 13. So if they set foot in any European country, they would be subject to arrest.
That was sort of what I was trying to understand, is that actually there could be, I was wondering if it would involve any of the EU countries and if they step foot anywhere. I mean, I know that was one of the things that they had talked about before. Was it Rumsfeld that had, you know, had to be careful about where he went because there were actual arrest warrants put out for him?
And that's right. There was investigations into Rumsfeld in Germany and in France. Mm-hmm. They subsequently went nowhere. There was not an arrest warrant issued. But, yes, he had to be very careful about what he did for a significant period of time. Mm-hmm. And similarly, these 13 CIA operatives are going to have to be very careful about where they choose to go on vacation.
Yeah. Now, this thing, actually, speaking of vacation, because this is one of the things that actually really got to me, was this guy, al-Masri, he was on vacation in Macedonia.
Let's make this very clear, Michael. He's never been charged with any offense. Mm-hmm. Never. But he was in Macedonia on vacation. He was just minding his own business when he was picked up by these Macedonian agents who were cooperating with U.S. officials. And then, ultimately, U.S. officials took Khalid al-Masri and spirited him away to their prison in Afghanistan.
It's very much linked to, I think, even the, you know, I'm going to be talking with Ray McGovern a little bit later about the idea that the Obama administration and Obama himself has propagated that the U.S. has the power to just, one, well, they're talking about going after U.S. citizens and killing them, no matter where they are, but this idea of extrajudicial murder and arrest in places that, I mean, here's this guy on a vacation and they decide that he's a terrorist based on who knows what. They pick him up. They take him to Afghanistan. They torture him. They do all this stuff. They took him to the salt pit of all things. And then, you know, all of this stuff goes on. And then they throw him out in a hill in Albania. And this is only after, I mean, as I understand that some of the things that you guys have written, this is only after they actually had a lot of discussion and debate over whether they should, in fact, let him go at all.
Yeah, I mean, what journalists uncovered was that there was internal discussions in the CIA, within the CIA, about Khalid al-Masri's rendition. And it was discovered fairly shortly after he arrived in that Afghanistan prison that it was a case of mistaken identity. They got the wrong guy. And this shows you what happens when you have no due process, no legal framework in place to prevent these mistakes from happening. If legal process was afforded al-Masri, he would never have been picked up in Macedonia. That's a plain fact.
Well, rest easy, citizens. The king knows what he's doing. That's all we have to worry about here. Let me move on to Jennifer for a few minutes now. Jennifer Turner is also from the ACLU, and she's currently reporting on the prosecution of Omar Khadr. Khadr was arrested in Afghanistan and sent to Guantanamo when he was 15 years old. He's now 23. During his 8 years in Guantanamo, he was tortured horribly, and he's scheduled to be the first Guantanamo detainee to stand trial before a U.S. military tribunal to face war crimes charges based on what was extracted from him through the use of this horrible torture. Jennifer, you've written very powerfully about the things going on with the military tribunals and the buildup to the, you know, the whole process of launching them in Guantanamo, and including the fact that four reporters have recently been banned from covering these military tribunals. And these were some of the people who were the most powerful and the most courageous in going out and dogged in their coverage of what's going on with these tribunals. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What actually happened there?
Yeah, sure. For the past 2 weeks, I was in Guantanamo observing the military commission's trial of Omar Khadr, who's a Canadian citizen who's only 15 when the Americans captured him and detained him at Bagram and then Afghanistan, and then Guantanamo. And during his hearing, we heard testimony from his primary interrogator at Guantanamo, who's identified only as Interrogator 1. Now, he himself has been identified in the press and gave an interview to the Toronto Star 2 years ago about his intention to testify in the case, but reporters were told that we couldn't mention his name in reports. Four reporters who mentioned his name were then banned from returning to Guantanamo. It's horribly problematic because this interrogator was court-martialed and convicted of prisoner abuse at Bagram related to the death of a prisoner there. And some of his testimony concerned his serious abuse and torture of Omar Khadr at Bagram.
Mm-hmm. And actually, just for people to know that this interrogator was actually the one that was responsible for the murder of, what was the guy's name?
His name was Dilawar. He was
a taxi driver,
and his case is covered in the movie Taxi to the Dark Side.
Right, right. And when you read what the torturers had done to this man and reducing his legs to being pulpified, the horror of reading the descriptive elements
of
this.
Well, this interrogator was the last interrogator seen with Dilawar and later pled guilty to abuse. And we learned during the hearing last week that Interrogator 1 was given clemency and only convicted and sentenced to 5 months in prison in exchange for helping out and testifying in Omar Khadr's case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that familiar?
Which raises more concerns about the concealing details of abuse and about the government's insistence on concealing his identity, even though his name has been in the public domain for at least 2 years.
Well, let's get into that, because that is, I mean, on the surface, that appears to be so bizarre that here's somebody who actually gave an interview to one of the reporters who's been banned. Was it Michelle Shepherd?
Yes, yeah. Michelle Shepherd of the Toronto Star actually wrote the book about Omar Khadr's mm-hmm. life. And she had an interview with this interrogator in which he said that he wanted to testify in Omar Khadr's case. And he gave the interview on the record and let her use his name. And he's been widely reported in connection with Dilawar's death as well. But now the Pentagon is trying to kind of put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak, and say, no, you can't reveal his name. Even though there's really no legitimate reason for concealing his identity at this point, given that it's in the public domain. And it really only raises more questions about the transparency and illegitimacy of the Guantanamo military commissions.
Right, absolutely. Now, you've made the point that the trial, the commissions, what's going on down there is much more about torture. It's really about torture and not so much about whether or not Omar Khadr actually did what he is charged with doing.
Absolutely. These hearings have been about whether statements that Omar Khadr made to interrogators should be excluded from trial because they were the product of torture and coercion. Now, Omar Khadr's lawyers say that Khadr was tortured and abused and that false confessions were extracted from him and that those statements shouldn't be used against him at trial. Now, if the defense lawyers win this hearing, it's widely speculated that the government really doesn't have a case against Omar Khadr, and we might end up seeing the case getting dropped against him and see him repatriated to Canada, which is really what should happen in this case. He's been in detention for 8 years, for a third of his life, and he's actually would be the first child soldier ever tried for war crimes in American history.
Yeah, it's incredible. And this, think about it, this was a 15-year-old kid who was severely wounded, and the questioning began as he's being hauled out from the initial medical care and stuff. And the horrendous stuff that's shown in here, I mean, it really gives you a sense of what is going on here, what the military is like, what the system is like. And I think that really does come down what the whole damn system is like. When they're talking about, I think there was the guy who was portrayed as the monster of Bagram,
mm-hmm.
you know, which, you know, yeah. To me, that was just incredible. And what he talked about doing, and it really gave you a sense of, you know, and even there, again, like you're saying, it's about torture and not so much about whether Khadr is guilty of anything, because what they're trying to do is really cover up what is the extent to which they will go to do this stuff. What is now legal and allowable? What are they upholding and practicing in the world? I mean, that guy from the Monster Bagram was just stunning, including both in the fact that he wasn't allowed to say so much that he did and he wanted to say it. And then what he did do was just like, it was incredible. It was really disgusting.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch the testimony from these interrogators, because some of them did want to talk about what they heard about or saw or did to Omar Khadr, and the judge just wouldn't allow a lot of them to testify about, especially abuse of other detainees. He wouldn't hear about what was allowed, what was standard operating procedures for torture and abuse, what had been done to other detainees and other prisoners. And it's tough because Omar Khadr was 15 at the time. He has made very serious allegations of torture, but his lawyers are trying to corroborate those allegations. And instead, we're hearing from interrogators like Interrogator 1, whose answer was almost exclusively, oh, I don't remember specifically if I did that specific thing to Omar Khadr, and wasn't allowed to talk about what he did do generally, or what was his general practice. Was it generally his practice to menace prisoners with dogs? Was it his general practice to beat them, for instance? And which are some of the allegations that Omar Khadr has made. So unfortunately, at the end of all of this, there's probably a lot we won't know about how Omar Khadr was treated. We know he had about 31 interrogators that his defense lawyers have identified, and only 7 will testify at this case.
Wow. You know, one thing that Interrogator 1 described, and I want you to tell people this because they haven't probably had a chance to even read this, and they should go to the ACLU site and read with both what you're saying and what Steve's saying about Spain and what you're saying about what's going on with these military tribunals. You quote what you call a bombshell testimony from Interrogator 1 describing a fictitious story that he told Khadr about an Afghan person that they sent to prison in America and what happened to him.
Yes. So Interrogator 1, like I said, a lot of what he did to Omar Khadr, or allegedly did, he didn't testify about. But he did talk about a fictitious story that he told Khadr. Now, Khadr was 15. He was gravely injured and in a gurney at the time. And Interrogator 1 said that as part of his interrogations of Khadr, he would try to terrify him. And one of the ways he did that was he made up a story about a young Afghan who lied to the interrogators, so they sent him to a prison in America where the other prisoners realized that he was Muslim and as a result gang raped him and killed him. And the interrogator one told this story. You could tell he had told it before because he just lapsed right into this lengthy story, very detailed, horrible details about the gang rape. And Interrogator 1 said, oh, but, you know, we were not allowed to directly threaten prisoners. So that's why we made this story up, that we would send prisoners somewhere where they would be raped. And it gives you a small window into some of the treatment that 15-year-old endured at Bagram.
Well, it also gives you a very large window into the nature of this society when you can actually talk about one of the ways that this guy put it out, according to what you had on your blog. He said that a bunch of big black guys and big Nazis, patriotic and angry about the 9/11 attacks, noticed the little Muslim because he speaks a different language, prays 5 times a day, and then they went after him. You know, it's like the big black guys, you know, it's like, what the hell kind of society, you know? And this is, you know, for everybody who thinks, well, you know, this, we're living in a colorblind society. Yeah, really? Think about this. This is like colorblind, and what they're actually talking about here, and how the kind of, it shows you the rotten thread that runs all the way through this society.
Sure. Well, and even more troubling is that our government's trying to use statements they extracted from Omar Khadr, using those methods and techniques against him in a case. Statements that are wholly unreliable and that his lawyers say amount to false confessions. That won't give us a result that we can count on at all in these military commissions, and it's really time to transfer him back to Canada so he can resume his life.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Jennifer Turner from the ACLU about the Guantanamo military tribunals, the upcoming tribunal procedure against Omar Khadr, arrested by the U.S. at the age of 15 in Afghanistan and tortured mercilessly, first at Bagram Air Base and then at Guantanamo for the last 8 years. Well, I think it's very important to keep in mind that the point that you make, and I keep going back to this, this is about torture. And this is about it's about the general acceptance, the societal complacency about torture. And the idea that, well, sometimes you gotta do things to prevent worse things happening and all this stuff that's going on. And so all of these things that supposedly we walked out of when King Obama came in, and then where are we now? Where are we now? You know, we're right back in, I mean, all the stuff that's going on and what's happening in this trial and the banning of these 4 reporters. It's very clear. I mean, when I read just the stuff that you had written, and people have seen Taxi to the Dark Side, and, you know, you realize that the power that has, if you know what's going on, it's very difficult to keep your eyes shut and your mouth shut. That's a very important element in all this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, as sort of my last question, and then we're going to have to take a run on it, they have offered Khadr a plea bargain, right? And what is that?
Well, we've heard reports that the government offered him 5 more years in prison on top of the 8 years he's already served. And we heard reports that Khadr's lawyers rejected the offer. Now, there's been a lot of speculation that maybe the government realizes its case isn't very strong and realizes that if Khadr's own confessions are thrown out from the case, that they won't have much of a case left. But none of the lawyers involved in the case will confirm those reports. The Washington Post also reported that the Obama administration is actively seeking a plea deal because this just isn't the perfect case to start to open up the military commission's trials under Obama. Omar Khadr's case will be the first trial under Obama at Guantanamo, and it's truly, from a public relations standpoint, a nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what? It's bad PR to have the inhuman, bestial torture of a 15-year-old kid that went on for 8 years until he's 23, turned him into a puddle of just a total mess of a human being. You know, and it's, whoa, geez.
Yeah,
surprise.
Well, also, just internationally, the town soldiers aren't prosecuted for war crimes. It hasn't been done since before World War II, and we would be making history by trying Omar Khadr for war crimes committed when he was a child.
That's a very important point, and we will have to get back to you on that one. I'm serious about that. I really want to explore that issue, because that's one of the things I think that Obama is really pushing out big. I mean, this whole idea of that began under the Bush regime, but also has been continued and developed under Obama, of this extrajudicial areas, the idea of drones, the fact that you can prosecute people, or even American citizens can be put on a hit list and ordered killed on basis of suspicion. You know, and that's an extremely, extremely troubling development and revealing about what's going on here. Jennifer, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
And Stephen, thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Okay, we'll talk to you both again soon. I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with Stephen Watt and Jennifer Turner from the ACLU about Spain's attempt to issue arrest warrants for 13 CIA agents and about the banning of reporters at the military tribunals going on in Guantanamo and the case of the 15-year-old kid who was picked up in the battlefield, Omar Khadr, who was picked up in the battlefield in Afghanistan, severely wounded, and his torturing began right after that, and now he's facing a military tribunal. We're going to take a short break and be right back with Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and current fighter against the war crimes committed by the Bush and the Obama regimes. Ray will be talking with us about the ad from the World Can't Wait organization entitled, "Crimes Are Crimes No Matter Who Does Them." So stay tuned.
I see kids fighting to find the boys. They've been swimming in the sea without a shore or a choice. Sometimes it's like I'm without a home. Last night I walked 1,000 miles alone. I can't live like this any longer. Your well is running dry as the oceans rise. If I'm right, we got one shot tonight. Boom! Die, 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 die.
Welcome back. That's Outer National with Fighting Song featuring Tom Morello. Just a brilliant band, a band that really gets me up and running around. And that's a hard thing to do these days, I'll tell you. Joining us now to talk about a new statement that has come out from the World Can't Wait organization called "Crimes Are Crimes No Matter Who Does Them. Crimes under Bush are crimes under Obama and must be resisted by anyone who claims a shred of conscience." And that just appeared in the New York Review of Books, the current issue of the New York Review of Books. And this is signed by hundreds of people. And one of the signatories is Ray McGovern.
Ray is a former CIA analyst and current fighter against the war crimes committed by both the Bush and the Obama regimes.
And Ray's here to talk to us about this statement, what's going on with it, what's the thinking behind it, and what do they think they're going to achieve with this. Ray, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure.
Good to be back with you.
Yeah. Tell people what's the genesis of this statement?
Well, as usual, it was a gutsy woman that had the first inspiration for this, Deborah Sweet of The World Can't Wait. She checked with some of us, and we thought it was an excellent idea. She drafted, we massaged, and we came out with, I think, a very strong statement saying, a crime is a crime no matter who does it, whether it's a Republican president or Democratic president. The most recent instance of this incredible arrogance, this assertion of a willingness and a justification under the law, so to speak, to assassinate people abroad, is this example of this this Muslim cleric, Al-Waqi, who Obama asserts the right to assassinate, even though he's in Yemen. Obama is acting as judge, jury, and executioner. And the wonder of it, Michael, and this won't surprise you, but it might surprise some of your listeners, is that the fawning corporate media is taking this in stride, saying, oh, I suppose he's connected with terrorists after all, so we can do what we want to him. The law is completely out the window, and the supreme irony is that this president styled himself as a professor of constitutional law.
You know, Ray, let's dig into that one, because that is one of the first things that comes up, one of the first highlighted points, you know, evidence that comes up about the crimes of crimes or the listing of crimes. This idea of assassinating anyone, anywhere, anytime, no matter what they did, no matter what you think they did, no proof, no nothing, no due process, nothing. This is a really a huge leap in the whole repressive apparatus in the world and in this society in particular. I mean, I was just, you know, I don't think, if you weren't stunned by what was actually just sort of thrown out there and then went by with a terrible complicity of silence, not just on the part of the, as you put it, the fawning corporate media, but also on the part of the public at large. You know, this was just outrageous, this idea that extrajudicial assassination at the whim of the president. You know, it's just like, wow. If Bush did that, people would have been rightfully just completely insane with outrage. But now it's sort of like, oh, like you're saying, oh, well, you know, this got to do some things.
Yeah, there's sort of an outrage fatigue that's set in, Michael. You know, people will accept pretty much anything. You know, the parallel between the 1930s and Germany is really shocking. Because the people there, you know, they kind of knew about what was going on, but, you know, they lived their lives, and they said, well, let somebody else speak up. For us, that is, for the United States, it's very new. And not only the targeted assassination of American citizens, but the open acknowledgement of such. Can you believe it that a government spokesman have asserted this right, and the CIA yawns and says, we don't do anything outside of the law. Right, yeah. Well, what law are they talking about? Well, you know, there is a loophole. You know, W.C. Fields was caught reading the Bible one time, and somebody said, well, what are you doing, W.C. Fields? He says, I'm looking for loopholes. Well, if you want to look at a loophole, it's one sentence in the National Security Act of 1947, which set up the CIA. And it says, and I quote, the Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence that the President of the United States shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Now, depending on the President, Michael, and depending on who is the Director of Central Intelligence, now it's the Director of National Intelligence, and whether they have any sense of morality or any sense of devotion to the law, that gives the president his or her writ large, his or her ability to use the CIA as their own personal Gestapo. Do not blanch before that word. How else do you get torture? How else do you get kidnapping, throwing people in black holes without telling their children or their wives, much less the Red Cross? How else do you get targeted assassinations? Now, if I sound a little angry, I would just ask your listeners, aren't you angry? Aren't you angry about this? Here is an American citizen. Now, for us, it's a first, but it's not for a first for our oldest and closest ally, the British. Did you know that the foreign minister of Britain, when he made that big, big demonstrative protest against the Israeli use of British passports, did you know that was all contrived? Did you know that the British gave Mossad those passports?
Huh. Really?
Yeah, we've just learned this. Craig Murray, the former ambassador to Uzbekistan, has an email to me today. He says he checked with all his sources in the Foreign Service and in MI6, as well as with noted, I think this is Robert Fisk, I think, in the Middle East, and that's its conclusion. So what am I saying? I'm saying that this this targeted assassination has been practiced by the British for centuries, some of it on my uncles and granduncles, by the way, and has been practiced by Israel since 1948. So we're sort of just catching up. We're the young boy on the block, just as we were in 1953 when the British took us through the traces in showing us how to overthrow the government of Iran. And we did real well on Guatemala. You know, what we have here, Michael, is what President Harry Truman, bear in mind, Harry Truman set up the CIA for a specific purpose. That was the part of the CIA that I worked in. We would have access to all information, so there wouldn't be this scattergun approach to things like happened before Pearl Harbor, and we would tell the president without fear or favor what was going on in the world. Now, what Harry Truman wrote in an op-ed in the Washington Post 16 years after the creation of the CIA was, what's going on here? I didn't set up this cloak and dagger operation to overthrow governments. And curiously enough, Michael, he wrote that op-ed appeared in the Washington Post on the 22nd of December 1963, exactly a month after President Kennedy was assassinated. That was no coincidence. And guess what? It appeared in all, there used to be three editions of the Washington Post. The one that I find on my doorstep, the early edition, then there was the city edition, another edition. Guess what? The Washington Post, unprecedented in my experience, pulled that op-ed out of all subsequent editions, and the rest of the media didn't run it. So even then, what Bill Colby, the later head of the CIA, said was true, namely, that we control pretty much every important personage in, he said, the media. I say the fawning corporate media. There's a big, big history of this, and to see this happening before our eyes with open acknowledgement was, yeah, we could do this. You know, that's arrogance. That's something that we thought we couldn't let go by simply because Obama seemed to be, and I stress seemed to be, better than Bush on these issues of extrajudicial assassination and things like that.
Let me remind listeners first that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst and a signer of the Crimes Are Crimes No Matter Who Does Them statement issued by the World Can't Wait. And this basically points out the continuation, the continuing line between Bush and his war crimes and Obama and his war crimes, and saying that they're crimes no matter who does it. And it actually points to, I think, to me, I mean, it, I think it's really true, this thing of you're looking at what is being created, what is the U.S. empire creating around the world. And Ray, I wanted to ask you one thing here. Another charge that is listed in this statement, and I think it's very telling and very compelling, the point about the U.S. troops firing on unarmed parties of Iraqis in 2007, the stuff that was revealed in the WikiLeaks video later, you know, the idea that there are all these massacres, including extrajudicial and declaring in a sense that, well, not in a sense, but actually declaring that war, the arena of war is now the world. And also Andy Worthington raised a thing where he said that linked to all of this and linked to the trial of Omar Khadr is the idea that they're changing the laws of war even to basically serve their needs and their strategic aims. And so now you have on one side people who are engaged in war can then somehow be picked up and thrown into a whole new legal category of terrorist who can either be assassinated on the spot, killed by drones, or thrown into Guantanamo military commissions. And on the other side, they can do wanton savage slaughter. And because they're America's side, nothing is done about it. And this is something that Obama has presided over and sharpened up into an art.
Well, unfortunately, you've hit the nail on the head here. There's the old expression, I guess it was Lord Acton who said it first, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I'm sad to say this because I had great hopes for this new administration. But as far as I can tell, that power was felt by our new president right from the get-go. You notice small semantic things. He started talking not about my administration or we're going to do this, we're going to... It was I'm going to do this. My, all this kind of stuff. And that betrayed to me a certain hubris, a certain arrogance. That aside, the military in Iraq and Afghanistan have rules of engagement. I was an Army officer, infantry officer. I know what these are, okay? And the terrible thing about the WikiLeaks leak, the gun sight photography that anyone can see now on YouTube, the terrible thing about that is, as we're told by one of the unit soldiers at the time, Josh Stiber, those were quite consistent with the rules of engagement that those young soldiers were given. Bobby Gates, he used to work for me, by the way, so I still call him Bobby. Robert Gates, our defense secretary, has justified it. And, of course, the fawning corporate media is silent, and our Congress. You know, look at our Congress. Take Jane Harman, for example. She was a ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee when all this stuff was briefed to them. Okay, that's how the CIA case officers do it. They brief you a little bit in behind closed doors, and then you become complicit. You become an accomplice. And who's going to raise a stink when all this comes out? Not the people who are briefed on it. So you got Jane Harman there, who is blessing all this stuff, who is actually drumming up support for another war against Iran. And so we have a chance, and she's just an example, but we have a chance here to show people that we really care about this Constitution, that we really care about the kinds of stuff that's going on. We really care about oversight committees, and they should not become overlooked committees. And there's a primary coming, I think it's in early next month, where the folks around L.A. will have a chance to pronounce as to whether they want this kind of person to continue to represent them.
You guys raise in this statement, and we might end up pursuing, if you can stay on a little bit longer, I think we might end up pursuing some of the stuff that you're raising around Iran. But I wanted to ask you this. You say that in some respects, this statement says, in some respects, this situation is worse than Bush. Can you explain why, what you're talking about there?
Yeah, the easiest answer to that, Michael, is simply that the administration's openly acknowledged that they reserve the right to assassinate American citizens, okay? They've already tried. There have been a couple of attempts to do in al-Awlaki. The British MI6 have sent hit squads there into Yemen to do it. Chances are they'll finally do it. And guess what? Because of the timidity of our media and our Congress, most Americans will shake their heads and say, we got him. He was one of the, quote, bad guys, end quote. Now, you know, bad guys shows the level of discourse that has eventuated in this country. So, yeah, it's really a new thing for a president to have his spokespeople first run, you know, we used to say, run it up on the flagpole, see if anybody salutes. Well, that happened in early February. The head of National Intelligence, Admiral Dennis Blair, before Congress said, yeah, we got a list here, and some Americans are there. Yeah, we reserve the right to assassinate them. Everyone yawned. The media made very little of it. And the next step, of course, was open acknowledgement to the Washington Post, to the New York Times, by high-ranking U.S. officials, and then non-denial denials by the CIA spokesman. So it's very clear what the new policy is. It's very clear that it's illegal as hell.
And it's also very clear that it's been consecrated into standard operating procedure by the Obama regime. And, Ray, I think this is a point where actually we are going to have to wrap it up. But I wanted to thank you very much for joining us. And we will have you back to talk about Iran, because I do think this is one of the most dangerous situations for the people of the world right now, that situation. So thank you again for joining us, man.
Most welcome.
Okay, Ray, talk to you again soon. I'm Michael Slate, and you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show. And we've been talking with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst and a co-signer of the Crimes Are Crimes, No Matter Who Does Them statement issued by the World Can't Wait organization. And this is, as I said earlier, it's signed by hundreds of people, and among them are Rocky Anderson, Ed Asner, Bill Ayers, William Bloom, Father Bob Bossie, Mathis Chereau, Elaine Brower, Noam Chomsky, Jamie Cromwell, Carl Dix, Daniel Ellsberg, Jody Evans, Donald Freed, Ann Fagan Ginger, Mike Gravel, Chris Hedges, Dar Jamal, Kathy Kelly, Blaise Bompain, Ray McGovern, Emily and Sarah Kunstler, Dennis Liu, Mark Ruffalo, Bill Quigley, and on and on and on. Cornel West, Andy Worthington, Anne Wright, and many, many more people. And it's in the current issue of the New York Review of Books. Pick it up, read it, get in touch with them, figure out what you can do. And you can get in touch with World Can't Wait at 866-973-4463. And you can also go to worldcantwait.org and you'll find them there.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign to talk about a new project they've launched to bust through the censorship surrounding the soon-to-end Proposition 8 trial, the trial focused up on California's anti-gay marriage law.
My baby, Sandy Posey. What can I say? I'm just a sucker for sweet, innocent love songs, and I really enjoy them, and I really enjoy that song. And so tough. If you don't like it, you should. Anyway.
Back in 2008, Proposition 8, an amendment to the California State Constitution, which outlawed gay marriage, became the law of the land in California. A legal challenge was mounted against this new amendment back in late 2009. This is the Perry versus Schwarzenegger case.
Joining us now is Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign. And Rick is going to talk with us about, you know, people have been following the Prop 8 trial, the Perry versus Schwarzenegger trial, and they realize that, following it to the extent that you can, because, you know, TV coverage was not allowed of it, you know, inside the courtroom. And the courts actually upheld the idea that there shouldn't be TV cameras in there. And basically, as a result, a lot has been hidden from the public eye about what's the content of the trial, what's at stake there. And Rick Jacobs and the Courage Campaign have developed a fairly interesting, a very interesting and really creative way of busting through the censorship. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. So why don't you tell us what this, the tactic that you came up, the strategy you came up with for busting through the censorship, and it's called Testimony Equality on Trial. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Well, Testimony Equality on Trial, which people can see at equalityontrial.org, is a 1 to 2 year organizing campaign that will allow and encourage Americans in every town to see what happened in the trial, in this historic trial, that most of which took place in January of this year. And they'll see it by doing guerrilla theater-style reenactments of the trial. And those started actually a week or so ago, but we had, when we launched, I think we had 7 of them. We had one in North Carolina. We had one in Madison, Wisconsin, in Texas, in New Mexico, in New York, and in California, just as beginners. And the whole idea is that guerrilla theater, which was founded in San Francisco in 1965, Abby Hoffman was a great proponent of it. Guerrilla theater is a way to get in front of people and show them something that they wouldn't see otherwise. And that's what equalityontrial.org is all about. You were not allowed to see what happened in that courtroom because the right wing succeeded with the Supreme Court in preventing television cameras from being present. So this is step one in that process. But we want as many people as possible in the country to go onto the website, download a script, and all the instructions are there, go out and do your reenactment and show your friends and your family and everybody else exactly what happened. Go to a town square, go to a farmer's market, and I think people will get a lot of attention on that. The second phase of this is that not only did people not get to see this historic testimony in court, your testimony, my testimony, everybody's testimony who's listening was not allowed in that courtroom, and we want it to be part of the body of evidence that goes forward to show that the American people are changing, and that people understand that being gay and lesbian and bisexual or transgender is not a choice, first of all, and secondly, that it is part of equality in this country, that the court itself, the high court, the Supreme Court, we hope rules in favor of that, and that we show that attitudes in the country are changing. So that'll be the second phase.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about the scripts, because just so people understand, you're actually taking excerpts from transcripts of the trial, and they're then being used as scripts. How are these chosen?
Well, Bruce Cohen, who's an Academy Award-winning film producer for, in that case, American Beauty, but he also produced Milk. Bruce Cohen, who is also one of the forces behind the trial itself with Chad Griffin that brought Ted Olson and David Boies together in that courtroom, went through the entire transcript of the trial and selected, I think, 19 different passages. Some of them are longer. Some of them are the testimony of the four plaintiffs. Some of them are shorter. One of them, and so you can go on the website, by the way, at equalityontrial.org, and you can click on choose a script, and you'll see right now 10 topics. Next week we'll add 5 more, and the week after that 5 more. And you can say, gosh, I'm interested in that. You look at it, you open it up, you download a script, which is the transcript. It is the literal, actual transcript, and then you go out and you perform it. Now, one of them that struck me, I live blogged that trial because, again, as you pointed out, it was censored. The courtroom was sealed up. And so I live blogged the trial. We had 2 million hits on our website, by the way, and 30,000 comments in a 4 or 5 week period. So one of the things that struck me during the trial was the piece of everything you always wanted to know about sex but were afraid to ask. And if you're of a certain generation, which is mine, I'll be 52 if I make it this weekend, you know that book. And in my case, I remember going upstairs, I grew up in East Tennessee, into my parents' bedroom and stealing the book and reading the passage about homosexuality and realizing that I was always going to be an unhappy guy because that's what the book said. Well, that passage was entered as evidence into the trial because it showed that there's been this consistent and persistent stigmatization of gay people. And so some folks took that, and that's one of the scripts. And some folks took that script and actually did something with it that's just extraordinary. And I encourage people to go on the site and look.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, actually, that one, and then there's a couple of others that really moved me. And
a quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign about a new project they've launched to break through the censorship surrounding the courtroom challenge to California's constitutional amendment banning gay marriage.
I really liked, actually, in the beginning, there seems to be, you've drawn on a number of actors and some very well-known actors, including Marissa Tomei. And I thought it was the excerpt that she did was very powerful. But then you also have other people, just ordinary people in San Francisco and other places, that including one I thought that was interesting down at Pershing Square, people from Orange County coming in and doing stuff. To me, it was just what was honed in those scripts was the core. What's at the core of this trial, the idea that denying people the right to marry whoever they want to is actually tied in very much with denying the humanity of a whole section of people. And that, to me, is intolerable. And that's what comes through. I mean, even, you know, the people displaying or talking about, you know, like the thing that you're talking about what happens when you read a book like that, everything you want to know about sex. Then the other thing is what happens when you're a 13 or 14 year old kid and you tell your parents that you're gay, and they suddenly become Satan to them, and they launch into a whole horrible, horrible, you know, regimen against you. And to me, the emotive impact, the emotional impact of that is just incredible. And it really helps you to understand what's at stake in this trial.
Well, you put it beautifully, absolutely beautifully. One of the scripts that we reenacted on Union Square after the press conference in San Francisco was what you just talked about. It's a guy named Ryan Kendall who was called as a witness in the trial. And Mr. Kendall grew up in Colorado. When he came out to his very religious parents, they did. They called him Satan. They said he was the devil. They threw him out of the house. They put him into, quote-unquote, conversion therapy. and they actually nearly killed him, literally. And to have him testify in open court about that was extraordinary. And so we reenacted that. Two volunteers reenacted that. That's the message. That's what, imagine having that happening in my hometown of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, or in somewhere, Omaha, Nebraska, or wherever it is. Local people telling the story of that trial in their own way, but using the words, it's unbelievably powerful stuff. And it really does, I have to say, you know, I guess it was, what, Wednesday night, Laura Bush said that on Larry King Live that she thought that same-sex marriage was sort of just fine, thank you very much. And kind of, I don't know how to put it, I was glad she said it, but it also echoed this trial. The trial, what's so great about this trial is it puts forward all of the arguments that the other side claims they have against what you just described as just common humanity and decency of allowing people to marry the man or woman that they love. And you come to see that it's very, very cynical, very, very prejudicial, stigmatizing stuff. And here's Laura Bush, whose husband benefited from the use of all these ballot measures in 2004 that divided the country to, you know, ballot measures in all these states to say that same-sex marriage is illegal. Here's Laura Bush saying, no, not so much.
Yeah, but she's just trying to draw people out so then she can then crucify them as Satans, okay?
Well, that may be the case.
Listen, Rick, we have to wrap it up, but it's been a great pleasure talking with you, and this campaign is tremendous. And I especially like the one thing that you guys came up with, the idea that, boy, wouldn't it be nice for flash mob scenes to develop around this, where people could go into Grand Central Station and start doing a scene from the trial. It would be just, I think that really is brilliant. I think it's really needed in terms of stepping up and out against the complacency and the acceptance of the denial of the humanity of a whole section of people. So, Rick, thank you very much. And how can people get in touch with you again?
We're at equalityontrial.org, equalityontrial.org. Please check it out. Please do what Michael said, start a flash mob. So check us out.
All right, Rick. Thank you very much. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Bye now. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show. Once again, I want to leave you with the thought that now more than ever, the world cries out for radical and revolutionary change. The world really doesn't have to be like this. Humans have lived differently before, including in societies not driven by the insane lust for profit and not based on oppression and exploitation. We've done it before, and we can do it again. This is what I aim to bring out each week in different ways, not only how messed up things are and what's behind it, but to highlight things and events that show how the world could be different. It's not only necessary to change the world, if the world is indeed going to survive, but it's possible to do it. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa, and my production assistants, Age and Henry Carson. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with yet another old-time song, old but still a killer, Time of the Season from the Zombies. Talk to you again next week.
It's the time of the season when love runs high. In this time, give it to me easy and let me try with pleasured hands to take you in the sun to promised lands, to show you everyone. It's the time of the season for love. What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
He rich.
Is he rich like me? Has he taken
any time to show
you what you need to live?
Tell it to me slowly.
Tell you why
I really want to know. It's the time of the season for love.
What's your name?
What's your name?
Who's your daddy?
Who's your daddy?
Here is he rich like me? Has he taken
any time?
Any time
to show?